It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, a quick little message while we're, as Tessa just said, under construction.
I'm just visualizing us with our little yellow vests and hard hats on.
That's right.
The do not cross line.
Yes. So those of you that are tuning in right now, we are recasting some of our favorite episodes from this final season of the Radically Loved podcast. Stay subscribed, because we are coming back the first week of January better and newer and more focused.
Yes. So excited for this. Here we
go. We're so excited. We're excited and also just like mortified. But let's not talk about that. We'll see you all soon.
Bye.
Hello, friends. I'm Rosie Acosta, your host and guide on this journey to self-discovery and radical love. I've walked a path filled with challenges. Growing up in East LA during the 92 LA riots, it left me searching for meaning, for mentors, for a way to truly understand the purpose of life. But you know what I found? The power of conversation. So I decided to create a space where we can share these conversations with you, our community. And that's how the Radically Loved podcast was born. Join me as we dive into topics like mindfulness, spirituality, self-love, and the keys to overall healthy living. I'm joined by my dear friend, fellow author, producer, and teacher, Tessa Tovar.
Hi, I'm Tessa, and I'm grateful to be part of this community because it teaches me so much about what it means to be human. Ever since I was a little one, I was always asking the deeper questions in life. Why are we here? What happens when we are gone? What is the purpose of life? I love this show because I get to ask the questions that cut right to the meaning of life. I've learned that no matter how much we want the path to be clear, it never is. And that is actually part of the beauty that creates a radically loved life.
Please do us a favor, share the episodes you love with your friends, and leave us a review. Together, we'll learn how to create a life that's truly, deeply, radically loved. Let's begin.
Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to Radically Loved. We are so, so, so excited to have Nate Klemp here, who is a PhD, a writer, a philosopher, and entrepreneur. He is the author of many books, more recently, Open, and I'm holding it up if you're watching online, Living with an Expansive Mind in a Distracted World. And Nate, Rosie and I have been so looking forward to this conversation with you. I know Rosie's a big time fan, and I'm just so honored to have you here today. Thank you so much for your time. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and I'm just so excited to be here with the two of you. I love what you're up to.
Thank you. Yeah, we kind of love it too. We recently came back together to co-host the show. I was kind of standing in as the host for a little bit. So it's been so nice to have Rosie back. And it's just, we're re-inspired and we're having a lot of fun doing this. So I want to talk, there's so many things, there's so many key takeaways from this book that you wrote, Open. Subtitle is key, Living with an Expansive Mind in a Distracted World. I think, oh my God, if we could just, we could create a whole podcast on just that subject. I mean, you were just saying you're on a lot of podcasts, but you don't have one yourself. And I'm like, well, that's a subject for a podcast right there. So, I mean, where do we start with all of this? I love the idea of practicing having an expansive mind. And certainly, I know, you know, so many of us feel distracted by the myriad ways that life, you know, kind of pulls our attention to many different directions, not to mention like technology and social media, all of these things. Where do we start? How do we start being more expansive?
Well, I think what you mentioned is really important. And part of the reason I wrote this book and started this whole project in the first place is I was having this experience where I felt like there was this subtle shift happening in my mind that was almost impossible to see because it was happening so slowly. But the way I would describe that shift is that it felt like the space in my mind kept getting smaller. And the reason for this, I think, is twofold. One is I started to notice just increasingly this irresistible urge to pick up my devices, to go on social media. And along with that, I started to notice a decline in my ability to self-regulate that urge. And then at the same time, I noticed a shift in my attitudes toward people who disagreed with me, particularly about politics. So they used to have a different perspective. And now all of a sudden they were like morons and the enemy and, you know, bad people and things like that. And I started to realize there's a word for what was happening here. And it's closed. And, you know, at first I thought, well, maybe I'm alone here. Maybe everyone else is just feeling great. But I started to see that this is actually baked into the zeitgeist of our modern culture, that many of us are just feeling this kind of compression of mental space. And the opposite of closed is obviously this state of being more open, where we have a more expansive mind. And that may not sound like a big deal, you know, like open versus closed, who cares, a little more space in the mind. But I actually think it's like the whole game. Because when we have more space in the mind, we're able to respond instead of react in a triggered way. We're able to have that space between stimulus and response that allows us to build new and better habits. There's more possibility, more creativity. Ultimately, the big argument for me is that we have more freedom. So I think it's a really big deal, this idea of shifting from closed to open.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And so what are some you have so many amazing stories, and I want to hear some of your stories. I'd love for the audience to get to hear some of your stories throughout the podcast. And I think where I wanted to start, before we hit record, you started to tell me about an experience you had meditating in the mall. And this kind of brings up the term you discussed, street meditation, which I'm just intrigued by. So can you tell us what you mean and maybe a little bit about that mall meditation experience?
Totally. Yeah. And hi, Rosie. Good to see you. So street meditation, street opening, those are two words I use to basically describe this practice of bringing our open awareness meditation practice off of the cushion. You know, often we're like, oh, I'm going to meditate. I need to seal myself away from distractions, or I need to go to this like serene mountain retreat center. But I actually think it's way more interesting to sometimes bring meditation into the environments of everyday life that are kind of like boring or irritating or maybe even somewhat scary. And so like I spent a day meditating at my local Costco, which turns out to be a really fascinating place. You know, I'd go like do a sit on like the Sun Via outdoor furniture set and then do some walking meditation, aimless wandering throughout the store, through produce, meditate in pharmacy. And I know it sounds crazy, but what happened for me is that there was this like total reorientation of perspective where all of a sudden, you know, it's kind of like staring at a beautiful work of art for hours. There's so much there that you don't see. And there's this possibility to just like reinvent our relationship with the spaces in our life. So I think it's an amazing practice. I'm a big fan. Not everybody likes it, but hey, that's okay.
Does anyone at Costco or anywhere you sit ever like approach you and say, you know, have any questions for you or tell you to, you know, get off the furniture? Or do you ever get any feedback while you're doing your street meditation?
Yeah, I actually did at Costco. One of the guys came over to me and was like, what are you doing, man? And I was like, I'm just kind of checking out this chair. I love this chair. And then it turned out he was the Traeger grill rep, you know, like the wood burning grill. I didn't know what it was at the time, but he's like, hey, I'd really like it if you'd come check out this revolutionary system for braising your meats. And so then I end up like talking to the Traeger grill rep, which can also have like this cool mindfulness vibe to it, you know, if you let it.
I love that. It's great.
Hi, Nate.
Hi, Rosie. How you doing?
Happy Pub Day.
Yes, today is Pub Day.
First of all, what an incredible book. Like, loved reading it. So I'm reading 80-80 right now.
Nice.
I downloaded it. So I'm like also learning about, this is another one of Nate's books that he co-wrote with his wife, right?
Yeah.
And if anybody out there is wanting to learn how to be in relationship, I would highly recommend that book as well. But I got the uncorrected proof, I think, of Open back in, I want to say October, November. It was a handful of months ago. And when I started reading it, it was interesting because I was really struggling myself with what was happening in the world, the things I was watching in the news, these sort of big predictions that people were having about 2024, and just kind of seeing this sort of mindless space happen in the world, in my life, around my family, right before the holidays. And this book really, it really helped keep me, I want to say, positive and open, no pun intended, because I was feeling a lot of that sort of like disillusionment with the world, right? With what was going on and everything around us. And, you know, like you talk about, I love the beginning, right? How you're talking about, okay, we're just like living our lives, you know, so monotonously, like we're just kind of going through the day without really paying much attention. And I think for me, just doing what I do, right? I teach meditation, I teach mindfulness. And it's interesting when you're in this position, you either get so good at being hyper aware or you become a little bit nihilistic. So I think for me, what was happening around that time is I became really, like sort of apathetic. And I think this book for me came at the perfect time, right? To remind me how important it is to stay open. And so I guess I would love to talk to you about what your experience was. I know that you were inspired by this world that we're in that's so distracted. And in a way, we're more connected than ever, but we're so much more disconnected. And I'd really love to hear, like what inspired you to do this and how you feel now putting this work out into the world. Like, what is your hope for people that read this book?
I love that.
Sorry, that was so long. It was so long-winded.
I love it. I think that the inspiration was exactly what you were getting at there, that I was feeling a kind of despair about the world. And I was also noticing that there's this place, I like to call it Screenland, that we go to all day, every day. And that Screenland just amplifies the despair that I feel. So when I go on my news feed or go to my favorite news site, every op-ed and editorial is some version of like, the world is ending. Here's why. Democracy is over. Here, right? Like, I mean, it's so intense. And then I go into Instagram and it's a different world. And it's like, everybody's amazing except for you, Nate Klemp. Your life sucks. And you have no followers and nobody really likes your stuff, you know, because it's not that great. And so I realized that Screenland was really messing with my perception of reality. And what was interesting is, you know, we talk about awareness and meditation. Well, a lot of my experience of going into this place called Screenland was happening underneath the level of awareness. You know, like when you go to Disneyland, you know, like I'm going to Disneyland. Disneyland isn't real. Like the Mickey Mouse that's walking around, that's not real. That's a dude in a costume. But for some reason in Screenland, it's like, oh, it's totally real. Like these people right. have these amazing lives and yeah, our That's world so is falling true. Apart. And so anyway, I guess all that's a long-winded way of saying that I wanted to see if I could create an alternative experience because I honestly didn't see what the alternative would be other than trying to make this better, you know, just like despair, I guess, but I didn't want to stay there. And so that's where this idea of like, can we change our relationship to the ways in which we're closing down, both to ourselves and our own minds through screen addiction, to other people through polarization? But then can we also cultivate practices that allow us to like, to see a little bit more of the reality that's happening, the present moment and, you know, the bigger perspective that I think is still there, but it's hard to see. And like you, Rosie, I teach meditation, I write about meditation, and yet I was really struggling with this. So that I found that super interesting.
Well, and to me, I think that's where, I felt like you're writing this book for me. I'm like, this is for me. He just got into my mind and he's just explaining everything that's going on in the world. And he's explaining different ways that we can begin to open. But I really appreciate when people in the space, especially the mindfulness meditation space, that can say that, because I feel like the misconception is that people that are in this world have everything figured out and they live this totally peaceful Zen life and they have no problems and they don't have, you know, they don't lash out at people and they're just like totally even keeled. And for me, we had this conversation actually. We recently had Sharon Salzberg on the show, and I was telling her the story about how when I started meditating, after many years, it kind of stopped working in the way that it worked before. And I just continued to sort of white knuckle my practice experience. I'm like, nope, I'm going to sit and I'm going to do my mantra and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to do it. And I do it for an hour and I have to do it. And it just started to create this deep level of irritation. It was making me short with everybody. All of a sudden, it sort of became this chore for me that wasn't feeling right. And so I think me talking about it and you know, talking to my mentors, my teachers, and just explaining what was happening. I mean, it's very, very obvious what was happening. I needed to evolve my practice. You know, I needed to do different things because my life was changing. And so I was changing. And so I needed to be able to approach my practice in a, I want to call it my opening. I don't know, for the purpose of the book and this conversation, I wasn't feeling very open. That's really the gist of what was happening for me. And just to bring it back to the book, something that really stayed with me, I like that you created this like system. You called it like the three shifts of opening, right? Where you talk about like the focus of the mind, the attitude of the mind, and like the size of the mind. And when I was reading this again, I'm going to go back because I feel like it made such an impression for me because of what was happening. It really felt like something that I could do. Like, I'm like, oh, this, I can do this again. I can create this experience again. I can connect back with my practice. I can get back into this open space where I'm visiting, I'm not going to say what family members, but visiting family members that are, you know, have different belief systems and are like constantly talking about politics that I don't agree with. And I can just sit here and really just be open and present. So I'd really, maybe if you can share a little bit about that approach and how you write about it in the book.
Yeah. First, I want to say you're reading 8080. I've been listening to You're Radically Loved over the weekend. Really fun. I actually feel like Open and You Are Radically Loved are like brother and sister books or something. Like really cool. You actually talk about open. I think like one of the last chapters I read, like at the end, you're like, try to open more. And I'm like, yes, Rosie, that's what I'm talking about. So I love that. And methodologically, what I love is that to me, there are two kinds of books. There are guru books where it's like, I have the answer. I live a perfect life. I spend all of my days in bliss. and here's my recipe for doing that. And then there are books that are like books about the way it actually is in the world, where it's like, hey, I'm trying my best here and let's go on this journey together and see if we can figure out together. And so I loved that about your book. And that was my approach as well. Aww. To say like, hey, I'm not a guru. If you want to read the book of some enlightened Lama, that like, go check out that book. But I've always found for me, it's actually more useful to read the works of people who are sort of in it with me, you know, and don't have it all figured out. In terms of those three pieces of opening, the three shifts are, one is the shift in the focus of mind. So when we're in that closed state, there's often this experience of unconscious mind wandering. You know, mind wandering is this psychological term for when we're just time traveling through the mind, thinking about the past, thinking about the future. And when there's a moment of a little bit more expansiveness in the mind, we have this shift to something more like meta-awareness, where there's this disidentification with the thoughts happening, the emotions happening. But importantly, there's also awareness, because I think that's the slippery, tricky thing about mind wandering. It's happening and we have no idea it's happening, like 99% of the time. So that's thing one. Thing two is this shift in the attitude of mind from this stance of withdrawal or turning away from life. And I think, you know, screen addiction is such a great example of this. Like, you feel an uncomfortable emotion, you feel a little afternoon anxiety, and it's like immediate withdrawal. I'm going to go onto Instagram or whatever it is. And when there's a more expansive shift toward opening, there's this willingness to approach, even if it's a little bit uncomfortable. And I like to think of discomfort as almost like, it's like the gate that you have to go through sometimes to get to the present moment or to get to that more expansive space. Because like, if you think about it, you're sitting there and you have two choices. I can be in the present moment and listen to the sounds and whatever, or I can go on Instagram. I don't know why I'm picking on Instagram today, but
that's fine. We do it all the time.
The path to Instagram, it's like, it's lined with like pleasure and comfort and all these little goodies and mind snacks. Whereas the path to the present moment is lined with, I don't know, a little bit of anxiety, like some thoughts in my mind that are a little scary. And so that's the withdraw approach piece. And then the last piece is that whole thing about size that Tessa and I were talking about earlier, that I think the fundamental difference between these two states is the feeling of like headspace that we have, that when the mind is closed, it's like we're looking through life through this long and dark tunnel, and all you can see on the other end of that tunnel is the one problem or the challenge. But when we have a more open perspective, it's not that the problem goes away. It's just that there's now like more space around it. And that's such a big deal, I think.
Mm. Can I ask you a question? I'm like, I know we're here to ask you questions. Do you really think it's possible for us to train ourselves or to learn the discernment to know when we're craving a mind snack and to make a different choice? Specifically with regard to social media.
I do. I think it's really hard though. And so I also think that there's this approach we have now that says, like, limit yourself, restrict yourself. Self-binding is what it's called in the science of addiction. And I think it's a cool approach and I'm not totally down on it, but I think there's also this interesting tantric technique where we say like, okay, I want all these mind snacks. What happens if I, with awareness and intentionality, just give myself a little buffet of mind snacks and see what happens? So as you know, this is one of the things I did in the book. I spent 3 days all day, every day, just binging on my favorite flavors of digital distraction. And it was really cool because it kind of like flipped the whole, you know, I went from that resistance stance, like, oh, I got to limit my screen time, to this stance of like, okay, I'm just going to allow myself to gorge on this stuff. And at the end, what was really interesting is I realized that what was drawing me in was novelty, the experience of like something new, you know, a new text, a new email, a fresh feed. But having gone all the way with my phone, for that long, I basically destroyed its superpower. Because at a certain point, there was nothing new to see. I felt like I had seen it all. And that was paradoxically like a really helpful way of unwinding the craving, for me anyway. I'm not sure everybody would be into that, but it's kind of cool to try. And you could do like a day of binging and a day of fasting. And they're both helpful because in both cases, you're doing something different from your ordinary habits. So you're going to get a different perspective.
Yeah, I loved that. And I'm curious because Tessa and I have talked about this before. I'm curious her thoughts on this specifically, because I tried that. You know, I did the gorge. I OD'd on TikTok, because for me, Instagram is like, I don't spend too much time on it. I enjoy connecting with people, and I love, you know, going in my DMs and like responding to people. But I feel like for me, Instagram doesn't leave me feeling great. Like I always feel like what you were saying, it's what you said, right? You feel like the worst version of yourself when you're done. And for me, TikTok was a little bit more, it felt a little bit more like educate. My feed is, I've talked about this before. I love my TikTok feed because it's like I watch pottery videos and I'm watching like DIYs, and it's just filled with like fun videos on there. But I started to become aware of how quickly I'd have some idle time. I'm waiting in the waiting room. I'm like, oh, I'm going to just go on there real quick. Oh, I'm just going to go. Oh, I have some idle time. I'm going to go on Instagram real quick, or I'm going to go on, you know, Politico, or I'm going to just really quickly, I'm just going to see what my Apple News feed is feeding me today. And it just became this thing where I'm like, okay, I'm going to just let myself just go, just have at it, go on. And after a while, it does create this sort of what they say happens when you're looking at a website, ad blindness, right? You sort of get to that point where you're not feeling that same dopamine hit. And at that, and it feels just sort of empty. And then I tried the opposite. I'm like, okay, now I'm not going to go on social media for a couple of days and see how that feels. And for me, it always feels good to disconnect. I always love the experience and I never, ever want to go back, but it's part of my job. I have to be on it. I have to do it. And it's part of, again, how I connect. But I really love the way that you approached it and the way that you talked about it. And Tessa has really good boundaries, I think, when it comes to disconnecting. You know, she goes and she does these incredible, like, I call them walkabouts. You know, she'll backpack and just go be out in the woods with like bears by herself and just like go disconnect. And Nate, I know you live in Colorado, and like what an amazing landscape to be in. So I'm jealous of both of you. I live in a city, you know, I'm in LA, and so I don't really get access to beautiful landscapes like that. But I mean, but I do get to, you know, go to like the beach or go on a hike. It's not as beautiful, but I'm curious, I guess my question is to Tessa, like what has been your experience with this? And if you have any follow-up questions for Nate.
Oh yeah. Lots. My experience is like I feel like I have an anti-addiction to social media. It feels like pulling teeth to make me go on it. And it's so much easier for me to just leave my phone. Like I was telling Rosie a couple of days ago, I'll often do tech-free Saturdays where I will purposely leave my phone at home and just not look at it all day. And I just, yeah, backpacking is the thing that resets me and nourishes me. And it's the perfect way to get away from all of this. But I think one of the things that comes up for me with social media, with watching things like news feeds, is this political outrage. And I know you talk about it in the book, Nate, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on, like, I think for me, I feel some shame and judgment towards myself because I don't feel like equipped to go onto social media because I feel all sorts of political outrage bubbling up. And then I judge myself for being like somebody who is too weak to consume this kind of media, to have an intelligent conversation about politics, to have an opinion even, because I don't feel like I educate myself enough around like the current political landscape. I just know that it makes me scared. it freaks me out. I'm not really sure how to address it in a safe, you know, when I say safe, I mean like a mindful way, an expansive way, an open way. And so I'd love to hear you address that, Nate, in terms of like, is there a balance we can strike between staying open, using these tools in the way that maybe they were designed to be used from that lens of like, let's bring each other together, let's lift each other up. And I don't know, maybe they weren't designed with that in mind. Maybe I'm being hopeful here. But yeah, could you speak to that kind of like, how do you deal with the political outrage and kind of burying your head in the sand sort of inclination that I so readily feel?
A couple things come up for me around that. The first is there's this idea I've been playing with of digital dessert, which has been really helpful for me, which is to schedule in my calendar time for binging on my favorite flavors of distraction and political outrage. So like for me, it's usually when I'm eating lunch. And what's nice about that is then during the morning, I'm like, oh, I should check the news. I should check this, that, the other thing. I can think to myself, I actually have my digital dessert coming up. So I think I'm going to wait until then. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But anyway, that can be helpful. On the political outrage piece, I really hear you. For me, I got my PhD in political philosophy. So I come at this with just like this intense passion for politics. I think it's fascinating. And as a result, I could spend all of 2024, if I wanted to, just reading about the election cycle and the primaries and whose polling numbers are up and what, you know, what the horse race and all this stuff. And you know, all the back and forth kind of, you know, this side's bad, no, this side's bad stuff. So what I realized in the context of this project is that it would actually be really healthy for me as a way of exploring opening to spend a little bit more time with people who radically disagreed with me. And as someone who's a center-left guy, lives in Boulder, you know, terrified of guns, hate even seeing guns, holding guns, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be interesting to spend time with the National Rifle Association? So I actually got my concealed carry permit with the NRA. I went to rural Colorado, and it was just this like amazing experience for me because I went into it almost as a mindfulness practice. Like I thought of it as a meditation retreat. Obviously a very different kind of meditation retreat when you're learning how to like shoot a gun and, you know, all the ins and outs of firing and things like that. But just hanging out with people who had radically different beliefs, it kind of opened up this part of me. I guess the big realization was that there was no enemy. That talking to these folks who are so radically different, having this realization that they're people just like me, they care for their families and their neighbors just like me. And yes, we have different beliefs. And I didn't end up changing my beliefs necessarily, but what changed was my perception of the other side. And I think that could be a pathway for us as a society out of what seems like this downward spiral toward ever more polarized beliefs about each other. Like, what if we just talked and were curious and listened? I think we could start making some pretty big changes in our culture.
I love that, Nate. Wow.
It's so good.
I do have a follow-up question about this. Placing yourself in a situation where you know you're going to have disagreements about, you know, beliefs. I love the idea of that. And then I think about putting myself in that situation. And then I think, I know all of my emotions are going to come up. So how do you deal with all of your emotions in those moments? You know, and you realize, I love what you said. I realized there was no enemy. How did you come to that conclusion emotionally?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Most crazy emotional experience I had is I wore my Denver Broncos hat. We live here in Colorado, thinking that that's how I was going to find common ground. We're all Broncos fans. I mean, everybody who lives in Colorado, right? And so I show up and one of my classmates comes in with a Kansas City Chiefs jacket. And I'm like, cracked a little joke. Like, hey, I got a Broncos hat. You got a Kansas City Chiefs jacket. I don't know if we can be friends. And her husband just kind of looks at me and comes up to me and is like, oh, you don't have to worry about that at all. We haven't watched the NFL in 5 years after the kneeling. And then our instructor is like, oh yeah, I haven't given the NFL a cent of my money after that. And so I'm sitting there thinking, first of all, the kneeling. Oh, okay. Black Lives Matter. That's what they're talking about. And I had this moment where I felt real fear. I mean, here I am surrounded by live guns and magazines and rounds, and we can't agree on guns. We can't even agree on a shared passion for a modern gladiator sport. Like, that's how bad it is. But then the craziest thing is I overhear a conversation between the same guy and my instructor. And he says, you know, I just think the right has all the best answers. But then he looks at me and he says, but we probably shouldn't assume things here. What side are you on? And I was like, okay, I'm just going to lead with what's true for me. I'm on the side of being open to all points of view. And the craziest thing happened. Everybody in the room like started smiling and the whole vibe of the room shifted. And everybody was saying, that's what we need more of. We need to listen to each other. And so I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but what happened in that moment for me is I felt some pretty intense fear, but I felt like if I just led with what was true for me in a way that was non-adversarial and wasn't trying to pick a fight, that maybe that would work. And it was weird because I realized we can't agree on anything, not guns, not the Denver Broncos, even though we all live in Colorado, but we can agree that we should be more open.
Mm. I love that. Thank you.
Oh my God, I muted myself and I'm just like talking away. Oh my God, that was so good. You write about that story in the book.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think that it's a simple fix, right? If everybody was open, if everybody was more open to all points of view, I think we'd come to a better understanding of each other, not be so rigid. And I think, you know, this is why I think this is so important. I think this book is so important. I think that perspective is so important, you know, to be able to have that openness. And you also talk about meditation and mindfulness and the sort of like, there's something about the glossing over how we see it in our culture, right? Like it's more complex than just, oh, you know, a celebrity meditates, right? I think that was the example in the book that you're sort of giving the example that we think of meditation. The reason why I think it's important is because I think that mindfulness and meditation are key to sort of maybe navigating those emotions that Tessa was talking about more, you know, like what do we do in those moments of being with somebody who, yeah, doesn't agree with us or says something that's a little passive aggressive or, you know, might say things that you know, you're clearly in this space where there's live ammunition everywhere. You might not agree with everybody that's there's ideologies or whatnot, but you're able to still be open and they're able to also be open. Coming back to the mindfulness component, I think this is where you talk about focused attention, compassion, and open awareness. And I feel like, you know, in thinking about this particular incident, when we are put in situations where we can, you know, take a moment and be open and not let our emotions sort of take over, what are some ways that we can begin to put that into practice? And I guess maybe just your definition of mindfulness and how you see it in regard to how we can create a better open existence within our communities.
I love that. I think there are so many different ways we can cultivate this experience of openness. But I think of meditation as like the training and conditioning program to give ourselves the ability in those really hard moments to be able to fall back on this more open perspective. So for me, that means, you know, every day I meditate. I'm not always successful, but usually successful. And as you mentioned, there are different styles of meditation. And I think it's really interesting how our culture has gotten into meditation as this abstract idea. But then the question is, well, what does that actually mean? What does it mean to meditate? And what's really interesting in the research of Judson Brewer is that he studied focused attention meditation, where you have an object of focus like the breath or mantra, compassion meditation, where you're doing something like metta, doing the wishes for yourself and others, open awareness meditation, where you're allowing the field of awareness to expand. He studied all three and found that all three are really powerful, and they all shut down the default mode network of the brain, which is that, like, the engine of the brain that's driving mind wandering and time traveling through the mind. So I'm of the view that there is no competition here. If you're really into compassion meditation, like, wow, awesome. If you're really into focused attention, that's amazing. The practice that I really like, that I do every day, it's kind of like a blend. I start with a super simple focused attention practice where I literally count breaths till I get to 10. And it's kind of fun. It's like my litmus test of my attention, because there are a lot of days where I get to 5 and then I'm like, what am I going to have for lunch again? And okay. And then I go back 1, 2, 3. So some days it takes me a while to get to 10. And then once I get to 10, I'll follow the breath, do a more traditional focused attention practice, following the sensations of breath. But then I like to end the practice with something more like an open awareness practice, sometimes called open monitoring practice, where instead of having a small object of concentration that you're trying to narrow the mind on, there's just a sort of relaxation that's happening. It's almost like, instead of focus being predominant, relaxation becomes predominant, and there's an emphasis on this bigger field of awareness that you're just kind of allowing to be as it is. And so I like that, because it kind of takes me through a journey of a couple different styles of practice. And I find that focused attention gives me the stability I need to be able to practice that more open awareness style without just, like, thinking about lunch. I like lunch, by the way. My wife, she is always making fun of me, because every day I'll be like, what about lunch? When are we going to eat lunch? Like, I don't know why I'm obsessed with lunch.
No, it's good. And I love that it's everything's like a snack, or, you know, the buffet. Yeah. Or I'm with you. I love a good food metaphor. Present me a good food metaphor, I'm all about it. I mean, I end my book with like a taco metaphor. You know what I mean? It. Like, I am just.
What's the place in LA? It. Tito's Tacos? Tony's Tacos?
So many.
There was one really famous place, but I can't remember. Oh, well.
I think Tito's is a pretty famous. I mean, there's a lot of places, but, you know, if you really want the real deal, you need to ask a local. Got like myself. It. Next time you come to LA, I'll let you know where I've taken Tessa to this place. Just a tiny little shout out to my friend Adriana. She has this very, like, she graduated. She used to have a little stand, a little taco stand, called Chingona. Nice. Which means badass in Spanish, you know? Well, it's something a little more crass, but we're just going to say badass just for the purposes of, anyway. But she kind of started right on Topanga, and those people local in the valley, or if you live on the west side, you may know or have seen her signs, but she now has a food truck, and it is the best. She has vegan options, like, she makes everything from scratch. She has, you know, a little like tortilla lady hand making tortillas. Like, it's a whole experience. Highly recommend. 5-star Yelp review. Can't miss it next time you're here.
We'll have a taco next time I'm in LA. I love it.
Yes, please. That would be amazing.
Now I'm hungry, first of all. What is for lunch? What is everyone having for lunch?
I'm hungry.
And number two, me too. I'm like you, Nate. I second that. I'm always, usually it's like, okay, the night before, what are we having for breakfast? Anyways, I do have a question here.
Not about lunch.
About letting go. About letting go of what you're going to have for breakfast.
Welcome to the podcast, Nate, by the way.
I'm into it.
I was thinking about, you were talking about like the phenomenon of meditation these days being kind of like this abstract idea, and how it feels like there's so much control around it. Like, you talk about this in the book, about the mastery of the practice of meditation. And we have this like beautiful image in our mind of what that actually looks like in practice. We're sitting on our cushion and, you know, nothing's bothering us and we're counting our breath, you know. And then I just love to hear you write about and talk about, you know, let's just take this into Costco and have our street meditation. And so I think the specific question is, you call letting go the ultimate practice of opening. And in this world where we're constantly striving for mastery and control over things, you know, why would we want to strive toward this more passive stance of letting go over the mastery of something like meditation?
I do call letting go in some ways the ultimate practice, because I think we live in a culture where we are just bombarded with this message that the whole game is about control. Even in the space of meditation, I remember my first long meditation retreat. I went in with this mindset of, I am going to harness my mind and I am going to create so much focus that I'm able to just ride out even the biggest waves of anxiety, you know, and I'm going to sort of master my mind. That was my mindset going in. After 2 weeks of trying and failing, I just completely lost it. It was like, I suck at meditation. And that's actually when I was having the best meditations and probably experiencing the most insight. So to me, letting go is this really fascinating practice, because I think we run in this cycle where we try to control, you know, we listen to all the like bro podcasts about the supplements we should be taking and, you know, all the like intermittent fasting we should be doing. And we do all of that and we like do the program and we read the books and we go on Instagram. But then we have this experience of not being able to perfectly orchestrate our lives, which is not very surprising if you think about it. But that leads to all sorts of resistance. And for me anyway, it goes in a cycle. Then I try to control more and then I realize I don't have control and then I try to control more. And letting go is like the way out of that feedback loop, where there's this recognition, I'm never going to have this perfect mastery over my life and I'm never going to be able to feel good all the time. And maybe that's okay. And maybe there's actually something interesting about these things that I'm trying to get rid of. Like I've had ringing in my ear, tinnitus, for 15 years. And I really tried the mastery thing on that. And it never went away. In fact, it got worse the more I tried to get rid of it. It was crazy. But I got to a point where I was like so worn down by all the effort that the only other option was for me to just be like, well, maybe this is just part of who I am. And that ultimately was the way in which I was able to just sort of accept and live with this experience of a ringing ear. But I think it's not just about ringing ears. I think all of life, we have these experiences, and letting go is such a powerful move. And when we do, I think there is this bigger perspective that we begin to see about what's happening.
I love that. That's so great. What a great question. That was really lovely. I have a question about setting boundaries. Setting healthy boundaries while opening. It reminded me of back when I was a teenager, when I first started my meditation practice. You know, I grew up in a kind of chaotic environment, and sort of me pivoting my life and changing my behavior kind of like exiled me away from my community and my friends, because they were all still getting in trouble and were, you know, some of them were part of gangs. And so I needed to kind of excommunicate myself away from them. And I had to do this really, I don't know, like nuanced thing where I had to not get into too much trouble, but get into enough trouble so that I could go to detention during lunch, so I wouldn't have to interact with them or, you know, get beat up. I'm going to do air quotes because, you know, you're teenage. I mean, these kids could have done some damage. By the way, one of them was a relative of mine, which is a whole nother topic. But it allowed me to, breaking away from that crowd allowed me to really find my own path, you know. And I was learning a lot about meditation and I was reading Jon Kabat-Zinn, Wherever You Go, There You Are. And I was just, you know, kind of exploring this world. As I got older, I learned how to create these healthy boundaries around people where I felt like, well, I still want to have relationships with these people, even though we're living completely different lives. How do I learn to do that in a way? Because it took some time for me to really find that balance, because I would kind of slip back into old behavior because of the people I was around. So I don't know if that's something that you can speak to with regard to being open.
Totally. Well, and before I get to the boundaries piece, I just want to say you gave me this gift over the weekend without knowing it, which is your story about your childhood was so powerful for me to hear. And the gift was, here I am in the midst of my book launch, writing a book where I put some stories in there that felt really edgy for me. And I spend a lot of time these days thinking like, should I have said that? Like, was that too much? And the gift you gave me was realizing my favorite parts of your book were those stories that were edgy and vulnerable. And it really like brought your book to life. And it gave me a little more confidence that, okay, maybe it's okay to share that sort of thing. So I just wanted to share that. And then the boundary, yeah.
Aww,
no,
thanks,
but seriously,
Nate.
It was like, it was really helpful for me just to be like, okay, like I can see that in someone else. I can't see it in myself because I have blind spots and all that stuff.
Well, but you know what's really interesting is those are the parts that I didn't even
write. And it was like my favorite part of the book.
No, no, nobody cares.
Yeah.
That's wild. And I would imagine that some of the stories that you put in here were, you know, some of the things that were so poignant for me, you know, like I love that you, yeah, the NRA story, like I thought that was brilliant. You know, I'm like, oh, this is so cool that he's like going out there, you know. I don't know if that's one of the edgier ones, but to me, it's like, I think that's incredible. And it speaks to your character, you know, which I talk about in the book too. I love character.
I think though, just to touch on boundaries briefly, because I know we're running up against time. I think there is such an important role for boundaries in all of this. And that's one of the misconceptions around this idea of opening is like, oh, if you open, then you just let everyone walk all over you and steal your money. And like, you have no boundaries, and opening is an unqualified good. And I think that's absolutely not true. Like, we want to open. There's power to that, to our own minds. We want to open to other people, but we have to have that discretion because there are ways in which we can open to our own minds and really traumatize ourselves. Like for some of us, we have traumas that are so deep that we're really not in a position to open to those unless we have the right support, therapy, stuff like that. Similarly with people, there are some people in relationships where if you open, so I actually interviewed Anna Forrest, the yoga teacher, and she was telling me about how for her, she was an alcoholic. And when she was getting sober, she had to close down to her friends who she used to use with, because if she had stayed open to that group, she would have been using again. So, you know, I don't know if there's any magic secret, but I do want to underline your point that opening has that nuance to it. Like it's something that's powerful, but we always want to be mindful of overdoing opening and keeping clear boundaries.
I'm so glad. Yeah. Thank you. That was, I was going to ask that question, Rosie. I'm so glad you did. And Nate, it's like we share a brain, Rosie. Nate, I love that. That's when I teach yoga, because I also teach yoga and I'm going into a teacher training. And that's one thing that often comes up for students when we're trying to understand the concept of like non-attachment and the practice for the sake of practice. And how do you do those two things simultaneously? And it's the same kind of question that comes up for me is like, how do you stay open while protecting yourself? And so I think that's such an, like, let's bold, underscore, highlight, exclamation point, this part of the conversation if we can. So Nate, thank you so much for joining us today. This conversation, I think we could just, like I said, it could be a podcast in and of itself.
This needs like part one, part two.
I would love to come back Just right? Name the date. I'll be there.
We would love to have you.
Tell me when to come.
Oh my God. Okay, we got it. We got it on recording.
Oh, I'm so completely now you're down. Yes.
All right, we're going to make it happen. So get ready, folks. Round two is on its way. And so congrats on your book. This is such a beautiful work. Where can people go to find, where do you like to connect with people on the
socials?
Yeah,
so you can find the book anywhere. It's called Open. Best place to find me is probably my website, nateklemp.com, Klemp with a K. And I have a newsletter there you can sign up for. You can get the book there. And then I guess I'll say you can connect with me on Instagram. I try to be on Instagram. Nate_Klemp.
I really do.
I try to put videos of me at the mall meditating. I don't know if anybody likes them, but like.
I have a whole, I try to comment
on your stuff.
He's in my algorithm.
Yeah, you're in my algorithm.
Yeah, I think that's totally. Why, because I always. Yeah, so that's great. I always love watching your stuff. It's really great. Yeah, we'll add all of those links in the show notes. Do you want me to ask the question, the final question, or do you want to do it, Tess?
You go, Rosie.
Okay. Tessa and I were like, we have a codependent relationship and people are really going to see how bad it is as these podcasts come out. Okay. Nate, thank you so much for being on the show. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time, and I'm so honored and I'm so grateful for all the work that you've done, for all of the platforms that you've created for people like myself and others to be able to share mindfulness and meditation and just this idea of being open. So thank you so much. It really created many openings within my heart and my mind. So thank you so much. So one final question, and we ask this question for all of our guests. The reason I started the Radically Love podcast was to create a space for people to come together, to feel supported, to learn, you know, different ideas, to get inspired. The whole idea is that the universe works for us and not against us. And we come from the belief that the world and the universe works for us, not against us, that we are radically loved and radically supported. So the final question for you is, how do you feel radically loved?
I dedicated the book to my grandma Hilda. And about a week before she died, she told me in her hospital room, in a lot of pain, "Nate, God is love. God loves you. God loves me. God loves all of us." And I don't know what happened then, but there was like a transmission or something. I felt radically loved by her, but also even just looking back on it, I just feel, my whole body is like vibrating right now. This, I don't know what it is. God, if I had to use a word.
Wow. I love that. That went straight into my heart, Tess. I could tell.
I mean,
too.
I almost burst into tears. I was like trying to stay with it.
Oh no, just, that's
yeah.
No, that's really beautiful. And I think that's one of the blessings about doing a show like this or being able to create content like this, to share stories and really to see our interconnectedness, because I mean truly that's what this is about. And I really feel like that's also like part of the ethos of this book is and really all of your work from what I've learned is to really see that we're more similar than not. And I'm just really grateful. Thank you so much for being here. Please come back and see us again. Happy pub day. Good luck, and we're so excited
to
have you
come back.
Thank
you very much for having me.
Hey friends, thank you so much for listening to the Radically Love podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. Also, don't forget to check out the Mindful Love Hub on Substack. This episode was produced by Tessa Tovar, music by DJ Taz Rashid.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.